Okay, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the final Question Time Society event of the year. Just before we start, a couple of quick things. Can you make sure your phone's switched off, if you've got one? And also, if you'd like to ask a question, just put your hand in the air and I'll come to you. We were supposed to have some microphones, but they should be here in a minute. So, and just shout loudly and should be able to hear you. Okay, the panel. First on the panel is Neil Hamilton. He's the former government minister and the former Conservative Member of Parliament for the Tatton constituency, once believed to be the fifth safest Tory seat in the country. He lost in a massive swing against him to the BBC journalist Martin Bell in the 1997 election, who stood against him on an independent anti-sleaze ticket following the very high-profile Cash for Questions affair. In December last year, he lost his case against Mohammed Al-Fayed in the High Court. He's also made numerous television appearances together with his wife Christine, including Have I Got News For You and Ali G. We welcome him here today. Next along is Bill Rammell, MP. He has kindly agreed to stand in for the Cabinet Minister, Lord Falconer, who had to go to an urgent parliamentary meeting, unfortunately. Cabinet meeting. Bill Rammell is the Labour Member of Parliament for Harlow. He was educated in Cardiff and is an active promoter of electoral reform. He is a strong pro-European and currently chairs the Labour Movement for Europe group. Thank you very much for joining us today and welcome. To my left is Max Clifford, famed for his strong anti-establishment views, his loyal support of New Labour and his personal campaign in bringing down the Tory party at the last election. He helped to destroy the careers of numerous high-profile Tories, including the former government minister David Mellor and the London mayor candidate Geoffrey Archer. He left school at age 15 with no qualifications and soon became involved in helping groups such as the Beatles and the Bee Gees rise to fame. Currently, he runs a highly successful PR company whose clients include O.J. Simpson, Jeffrey Boycott and Muhammad Ali. We welcome him here today. To my right is Peter Hitchens. He is a highly outspoken columnist for the Express newspaper with controversial views on Europe and New Labour. He is a strong supporter of British institutions such as the royal family, married life and the nation state. Whilst at York University, he was a Trotskyite and worked at the Socialist Worker newspaper. He later underwent a strong shift right and has been with the Express since 1977. He stood against Michael Portillo to be the Conservative candidate for Kensington and Chelsea by-election. We welcome him here today as well. And finally on the panel is Mark Oton, MP. He is the Liberal Democrat Member of Parliament for Winchester, who famously but highly controversially defeated the Conservative candidate Jerry Malone in the 97 general election by just 2 votes. This led to several recounts, a challenge in the electoral court, and eventually a by-election 6 months later, in which he won by an extra 11,000 votes. In October last year, he was appointed PPS to his party leader, Charles Kennedy, and is currently the party's official spokesperson for Europe. He is strongly in favour of joining the euro currency. Welcome also. Okay, our first question is, with the Conservatives just a few points behind Labour in the latest opinion polls, can they win the next general election? Peter Hitchens.
Yes, undoubtedly they can. And in this time of low polls and broken party allegiances, I think that the collapse of support for Labour among its own keenest adherents is causing a great deal of worry for the Labour Party. I think it's probably more likely at the moment, if you were just looking at the mathematics, that the Labour Party could still be the largest single party after the next election, but unable necessarily to form a majority without the Liberal Democrats. That's something which I think Mr. Blair would like to happen, because it would enable him to do what he's always wanted to do, which is to abolish the Westminster Parliament as it currently exists and replace it with some ghastly semicircular chamber in which you could never ever get rid of the government again through. And this possibility tortures me, but I think there is a growing understanding among the people who were suckered by the Labour Party and its unscrupulous and dishonest campaigning at the last election that it wasn't actually a combination of Christmas, the French Revolution and the Second Coming when Tony Blair arrived in Downing Street to that fake spontaneous demonstration on May the 7th, 1997, but actually just another Labour government. And those of us who are decrepit and old enough to remember, very similar to the equally disappointing fraudulent and incompetent government headed by Harold Wilson, which stormed into office in 1966 on an enormous majority and threw it all away in 4 years. So yes, I think it is possible, and I think the realization that it is possible may revive the moribund democracy in this country. What's been happening over much of the past 3 years has been that large numbers of otherwise sensible people have acted as if there was no opposition. And since, as Richard Neville once rightly said, that there may be a very small difference in this country between the Labour and the Tory parties of a few inches, it is nonetheless in those few inches that we all live and in which freedom exists. And the fact that it is possible that this government may be thrown out, a highly desirable thing, at the next election, seems to me to be very good news for democracy as well as very good news for the country.
Thank you. Max Clifford.
No, I don't think they've got any chance. Hope not. I think as long as people remember Neil, Jonathan Aitken, David Mellor, Geoffrey Archer, and what they were all about, they've definitely got no chance, because I do think that the word sleaze and corruption, backhanders, is still very much hand in glove with Conservative. Our memories are a bit longer than 3 or 4 years, so it's going to take a long time for the public to forget what a corrupt, sleazy lot that they were. And William Hague is maybe a good head prefect, but never a headmaster. So no, they've got no chance.
Neil Hamilton?
Well, what I like about Max is his charm. But I don't think that Max's analysis of the last election is going to help him too much in relation to the result of the next one. Although I will say this, that the Tory party is doing a lot better than it was doing in the polls, but then it was hardly possible to do worse. And I also know the opposite of the question, which is that however far ahead you might have been on historical analysis in the polls, or indeed even in actual votes, it is always possible to cock things up so gloriously that you end up losing. Of course, I've led the way in that department personally. So I think the election result, whenever it occurs in the next 2 years, is still highly unpredictable. And I think what we are seeing, where Blair is concerned, is the chickens coming home to roost, because a government which isn't firmly bedded in some kind of principle and which is guided only by what the focus groups tell you at the time is ultimately going to become internally incoherent, because public opinion is very fickle. And if you divorce your decision-making from some kind of bedrock of principle and only go for the morning's headlines, then ultimately everything's going to fall apart. And I think that is now what we're seeing. Having said that, I can't say that the most attractive face of the Tory party in electoral terms is its leader. And politics is personalised to a great extent today. And although I think he's done very well recently, he has a great deal to make up. So I think, personally speaking, that Labour may well squeak in again, but certainly a large part of its majority, I'm sorry to say, Bill, I hope it doesn't include you, will disappear.
Bill Rammell, perhaps you'd like to reply to that.
I was going to say I had a higher majority than most people, but then I remember your result, Neil, so that's no security. I'm by no means complacent about the result of the next general election. And, you know, for the whole of my adult life before the 1st of May 1997, I lived under a Conservative government. And suddenly, within 2 or 3 years, the consensus has been established that Labour are unchallengeable in power. I genuinely don't believe that to be the case. And I actually think, in terms of motivating and mobilising Labour supporters, the fact that up until now the Conservative Party has not been seen as an electoral threat has done the Labour Party no favours whatsoever, because it's actually meant that people think, well, of course Labour are in there, we don't like this, we don't like that, and, you know, maybe we'll not come out to vote. It's also the case that we are now in a period of midterm blues, and frankly it is astonishing, because midterm blues has taken place under every government in living history, and it's astonishing that it's taken this long for criticisms to be voiced and a blip in the opinion polls to occur. Undoubtedly, people have concerns. The Labour Party and the government have got to respond to those and listen to those. But we've also got to strongly, I think, get across our record to people. You know, the economic conditions that we have created are the best there's ever been in a generation. Now, I grew up with 3 million people unemployed in this country. We now effectively have full employment. And as the new money is now coming through to schools and hospitals, I think real progress is being made. So I think, one, we've got a campaign on our record. But two, we've actually got to rightly highlight the alternative, because whatever reservations people have about the Labour Party, the alternative is a Conservative government led by William Hague. And I think we have really seen over the last few months exactly what that would mean. Playing the race card, as the Conservatives have always done, and we've seen that on asylum and immigration, bringing us to the brink of withdrawal from the European Union, which would put 3.2 million British jobs at risk. And still fundamentally having a totally split party, because particularly on the issue of Europe, within the House of Commons, there are a whole series of different views.
Is William Hague not in tune with public opinion? He's just 3 points behind in the opinion polls.
Well, I mean, I polls go up and down, and I'd look at the longer-term trend, and I also think I'd say, before Mark says it, that, look at turnouts. The local elections were bad for the Labour Party, but when you actually had a higher turnout in the Romsey by-election, where people could really focus on the alternative being the Conservative Party, you saw a massive swing against them in one of their safest seats in the country. So I'm not complacent. We've got to get our message across. But I do
Can
not...
Can I just ask you something?
Well, no, Peter, well,
You just said playing the race card, which is a very potent and unpleasant allegation. Could you please give me one instance of any racially prejudiced remark, any speech, any statement calculated to create racial tension made by any spokesman of the Conservative Party whatsoever, or withdraw that rather low allegation? It's constantly being made by Labour spokesmen. There's no basis for it, whatever, and you know it.
Well, I'd actually take you back to the document that was written by Andrew Lansley, who was then the Conservative Director of Research and is now a leading frontbench spokesperson, who in the run-up to the 1997 general election actually wrote a paragraph within that paper saying we must play the race card against the Labour Party. The Tory Party has always done it.
Have you got that with you?
Well, I'll happily provide
you send it. You send it to me.
I don't think any such thing was said. After the meeting, Peter, because you know it exists and I know it exists. And when you attempt to use the issue of asylum and immigration to wholly distort the situation, to play on people's fears and apprehension, I think that is playing the race card.
We'll let Mark
check it out.
Mark Urson.
Thank you. In answer to the question, I don't think there's a hope in hell, frankly. And I think the problem lies around the leader of the Conservative Party. Generally speaking, most of the public think that he's a nerd. And he suffers from the Kinnock factor on this. And it's one of those issues that however nice the guy may be, however good his ideas may be, there's a personality problem. And the British public tend to focus in very much in the way they did with Kinnock, who was, again, nice guy, but the image was ginger-haired, windbag, Welsh. And I think people have got a similar image of Hague as being Yorkshire nerd, wearing the baseball cap the wrong way round. And ultimately, that's the big problem the Conservative Party had. What he has been extraordinarily successful in doing in the last 2 months is to actually take a lead of his party and to put himself on the box day in, day out. And we've seen the kind of issues where he's been talking some strong language on asylum seekers, where he's been taking an anti-gay stance on Section 28, and where he's been virtually supporting the kind of actions that guy Tony Martin did when he shot the criminals coming into his garden. Now, those are populist issues. Those are issues which will give you a quick flip in the opinion polls. But deep down, I actually think what matters to people are not those issues. What matters to people is what's going on in the health service. Can their granny, can their child get treated when they go to A&E? How large is the classroom size where their kid is being taught? And on those fundamental issues, the Conservatives, frankly, have nothing new to say. But the problem for Blair is equally, when I speak to teachers or people in the health profession, they feel a sense of great letdown that the promises which were so easily made before the election have not actually been kept. And that's why I think we're seeing this change in the opinion polling. There's a disquiet that the promises haven't been kept on key issues on health and education, and there's a short-term populism for a guy who's running around the country saying some pretty cheap things to try and shore up the right-wing vote.
Does that mean
that's my judgment of where we are, but the result at the next election, I think, will broadly be the same as it was at the last election, however, with a very low turnout because people are getting, sadly, turned off with politics yet again.
Do you think that Charles Kennedy might become the next Prime Minister?
No, I don't. There's an honest answer. Not next time round. Watch it thereafter. But not next time round. I'm not going to lie to you. I can't see it happening next time round.
Do you think you'll be in the cabinet after the next election?
I don't think that's going to happen either. I think that we're looking, if I'm being honest with you, at a pretty similar size election result next time round. The only danger for Blair is if his supporters are so dissatisfied they decide not to vote, or if the public assume he's going to win and just stay away. And then we'll see a low turnout in which the Conservatives, if they bring their support out on these right-wing issues, can actually win quite a few more seats. Then we may see the majority drop down. Not, can in my judgment, significantly enough to allow the Liberal Democrats to form a coalition with them.
Can I take any points from the audience? Have you got any questions or comments?
Can I respond to that? Tradition and history are absolutely right when they're justified. The three examples that you quote, I passionately have believed all my political life, are wrong. The House of Lords, I simply think it is wrong that we have had hereditary peers voting in our Houses of Parliament simply on the basis of the family that they were born into. And that is why it's been absolutely right that this government has done away with that. Fox hunting, I think it's wrong for people to chase and kill and maim an innocent animal. That's why we're bringing in the ban on fox hunting. And Oxbridge,
you're not bringing it in.
When you look at the Sutton report, which clearly identifies that many more kids from state schools should get into Oxford and Cambridge and the leading universities and don't, I think that's a real and justifiable concern, and one we should be taking.
That brings us on to the next topic, which is elitism. I mean, does it, after Gordon Brown and Tony Blair have spoken out on elitism in Oxbridge, they interviewed a number of state school students at Oxbridge and they said it hasn't helped the whole issue. Why is Gordon Brown and other senior cabinet ministers doing that if it's not actually helping them?
Well, there's a real issue of concern. If you look at the Sutton report, and this is the Sutton Trust report, and it's not government propaganda, it's an independent research report which has identified that something like 25% or more pupils from state schools should gain access to the best universities in the country and don't. Now, we can have a long debate about why that is the case, but I think that highlights the fact that it is a real issue of concern. And that's why their proposals to go out into state schools, to put in mentoring schemes, to actually encourage children from state schools to apply to those universities is absolutely important. And why, as well, they are right to look at their selection procedures. Because I'll give you one example of one of my constituents who came from Harlow, an urban working class new town, 20 miles north of here, went for an interview at Cambridge and had the ridicule taken out of her on the basis of her accent by the interviewer. Now, that actually made the national headlines and got into the national press. And when something like that occurs, and you put it alongside the significant underrepresentation of young people from state schools at our best universities, I think that highlights there's a real cause for concern. And that's why the government was absolutely right to say what it did.
I can't believe that I'm hearing this from a spokesman of the Labour Party. Until the Labour Party smashed up the grammar schools, which allowed the children of the poor to get into university without their parents having to find huge fees. Until the Labour Party smashed up the grammar schools, the number of working class students at Oxford and Cambridge was rising year by year by year, and it continued to rise until that moment. Labour destroyed them. The next thing that Labour does is to introduce tuition fees to try again to drive the children of the poor out of the university. Then it tries to set itself up as the party which gets the underprivileged into university. It is the party of privilege and the party which has actually made our education system more closed to the poor than it has been at any time in the past century, slamming the last door a couple of years ago by smashing up the assisted places scheme, which allowed many poor children to get into good schools and get into good universities. It makes me so angry to hear this drivel coming from the Labour Party when they themselves have been responsible for such an educational disaster. And the only answer they can come up with is reduce the entrance standards of some of the best universities in the world to cope with the fact that they've destroyed the state education system and reduced its standards. Why can't you just go back, apologise for the mess you've made, and start putting right the state education system instead of all these stunts and gimmicks schemes and task forces which do nothing, absolutely nothing at all.
Max Clifford, if you want to respond on the elitism in Oxbridge, do you think? Do you think Gordon Brown and Tony Blair are helping the situation by speaking out? And
well, I mean, that's how it is. Whether by speaking out they're going to change it is another matter. I will make one interesting point because it's something I'm involved with. Tony Martin, the farmer, is a client of mine. And when I went to... sure. Tony Martin, the farmer, is one of my clients, unpaid. When I went to Amanda Patel and told her about what had been going on to see if it was something they wanted to take up, no interest at all. I then got, or it happened, that the editor of the Daily Telegraph, Daily Mail and Sun decided it was a good campaign because their readers, 95% roughly across the country, responded. So then, a week, 10 days, 2 weeks later, William Hague started saying how disgusting this was. That's William Hague. That's not political, that's just a fact, that's what happened. He wasn't interested. It became something that he could score a few points, so he jumped on the bandwagon.
Right, Neil Hamilton?
Well, I'm interested in this point about the House of Lords having been undemocratic when it was full of hereditary peers, but apparently it's much more democratic now it's full of people who've been appointed by Tony Blair. And Tony Blair's made over 200 peers since he became Prime Minister only 3 years ago, and I think he made more peers than any previous occupant of his office. What they've done, of course, is to destroy one of the most independent parts of our parliamentary institutions, whatever its democratic deficiencies, and tried to make it into a pliant tool of the elected part of the legislature. And given that in the House of Commons all MPs are whipped through the lobbies to vote for things that they spent their lives opposing when they were in opposition, doesn't seem to me to be a democratic improvement. So I think we'll have a little less hectoring on the virtues of democracy and consistency from the Labour Party, because what we've seen there, of course, is an organised apostasy. When I was first elected to Parliament in 1983, Tony Blair was a new boy as well. Michael Foote was then the leader of the Labour Party, and Tony Blair was a very enthusiastic supporter of CND, a party which then had in its manifesto that they were going to leave the European community, they were going to vastly extend nationalisation, predatory taxation, 97.5% in the pound at its top rate, all those things they were in favour of. Margaret Thatcher, of course, converted the Labour Party. And I'm delighted that we've got such a right-wing government in this country today. I think it's one of the things which may well help them to win the next election.
Thank you. Marcus?
Why did Brown say it? I suspect Brown decided to get involved in this because he was getting slightly nervous that Blair was losing core Labour support, and he wanted to try and drag the government back to saying some populist things amongst their core voters. And one of the things that Blair loves doing is this, what's being called this big tent approach to government. I can probably say most things to attract most people towards the Labour Party. And I think that he's come a cropper of that. And we saw how he came a cropper when he spoke to the WI. And, you know, I've only been doing this job 3.5 years or so. And I've begun to realise that you cannot, in this job, be all things to all people. It's tempting to do it at times. And there's nothing harder than when you're in front of a hostile audience to try and say things which are sympathetic to them. You will come a cropper, and sometimes in politics you've actually got to frankly piss people off by saying what you really believe in. And I think that what Brown was trying to do was to put a warning shot across Blair to say, look, get back to some core values, stop trying to appeal to all people at the same time. But on the issue of education itself, I went to a comprehensive, a tough old rough comprehensive. I didn't have a university degree. Frankly, I don't think I've suffered a great deal from it. I don't understand what all the fuss is about. I do not understand why we have to have so much dogma in education. From my perspective, I don't care whether people are taught in a grammar school, a comprehensive, what kind of poly, university, call it what you like, they go to. What I want to see is good quality teaching at all levels for all people, provided whether it's in the private or the public state. And for God's sake, if we can just keep dogma out of education, we'd go a lot further in this country in the same way that some of our foreign competitors do, where they have a much broader education system which has allowed for a range of providers in it, rather than getting so hung up with an education system in this country which is basically hung up by old class issues.
Okay. Can I take any other... Are there any other questions from the audience? Anyone wants to ask anything?
Education, but where I live in South London, the local Liberal Democrats
Well, he's wrong, in my view. I can differ with him on that issue. What we have said as a party is that we will not take a national issue on this, but we do want local people to be able to make a decision themselves in local areas. Now, if in that area they have ballots and they take that decision, fair enough. That's what local people want. What I don't want to see is the party, our party, particularly prescribing a national position on these things. I think we should allow freedom of choice for individual areas. If they want to campaign for that in a local area, fair enough.
If the audience, if the audience sounds as if they like grammar schools, you're in favour of them. If they sound as if they're against them, you're against them. Wherever you are, wherever you happen to be, the policy will be what will get you elected.
It's actually called allowing people choice.
You were the one who just said it wasn't a good idea to try to please everyone.
It's not a good idea for politicians to try and do it. It's a damn good idea for politicians to let people decide what they want in a local area, and that's what we're doing.
Thank you.
You're off message, Bill.
Page message. Any other questions from the audience? Sir?
Yeah. Governments lose elections, they don't tend to win them. And the credibility gap is a major problem. That you've got to encourage the younger members of the audience here to vote. And I think we need more honesty to know that will happen. So if you take a specific example, we all know that we want people in accident departments and hospitals to be seen. Now, I had a particular instance recently where someone went 8 hours and were not seen. Because it is grossly underfunded. So that's fine. If the politicians say to us, we haven't the money, we can't afford it. But if, on the other hand, our leaders are saying, we have the money, we're putting it into the health service, we're going to fund accidents and emergency departments. And in our area in the country, they're talking of closing the wretched thing down altogether. So more honesty for politicians across the board.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, you take a very interesting... What's so funny about that?
Well, you couldn't agree with everybody more. That's all. That's what Liberal Democrats do. They agree with everybody.
The honest situation in relation to A&E departments is that there's been an enormous increase in the number of people going to A&E departments, something like a 17% increase in the last 10 years. And we need to examine, first of all, why that's happening. The difficult thing for a politician to do is to turn around to the local community and say that we cannot afford to carry on providing an A&E in every single town. Bill, Neil, others all want an A&E in their constituency. Probably the truthful thing to say is that with the escalating costs going on, we can't afford to continue to do that. What we've then got to do is to turn around and say there needs to be some centres of excellence, there need to be an A&E departments in the region where we can get people in there within an hour so that they're given the critical treatment that they need. The difficulty is that no politician is going to have the honesty to turn around and say, I think my A&E department should be shut down, because the best healthcare for people in my area is to create one big A&E department where the ambulance can get there and give them high quality treatment. And I think that's where the honesty comes in. Are you prepared to turn around to the public and say, these are some tough decisions, we cannot afford it, you're not prepared to put income tax up to afford it, so we've got to come up with viable alternatives. And sometimes those viable alternatives are very difficult for politicians to talk to the community about. And I wish on some of the health issues we could pull the party politics aside slightly and all agree that we need to be much more open and honest about how we're going to deliver good quality health service. It will not just require money being thrown at it. It will require some very difficult choices about rationing the role of the private sector and occasionally, yes, shutting A&E departments down so that we can create larger, more effective A&E departments in regions.
Okay, thank you. Bill,
yeah, I mean, I think you do need honesty, and I mean, I would acknowledge that I think the government actually created a problem for itself initially after the general election by overinflating the progress that was being made in the National Health Service, and that now gives us a political problem, because if you look at it objectively, we are now in a situation where there really has never been as much money being put in as there is now. I mean, to put it into context, under the last Tory government, the real terms increase was 2.7% above inflation. It's now, for a five-year period, going to be over 6%. What difference does that make? 2.7% allows you to stand still. 6% enables you to, over time, to start to improve the service. And you know, it's actually the money that the Liberal Democrats were calling for, so I'd hope that Mark would actually acknowledge that. But he's right as well that it's not just about money, it's also about changing the system. And one of the things that I think we need to do is the unresolved problem from the creation of the National Health Service is actually the status and role of the consultants and the power that they wield within the health service. And I hope that within the national plan that's going to be published in July, that issue will actually be tackled.
Okay. Any other questions?
Everything goes on. It does seem to me to think that you're actually over the people coming to club. And you're not just in other issues, shooting, sporting, fishing, and other things, because of your animals, particularly the way it's run. It does seem to be yours, class war, war, sky, blue, wheeled up for the election process, more than anything else. And alternatives to fossil fuels, as they are, seem to be particularly linked in order to increase problems for the future.
Okay. Very brief on that.
I simply wouldn't describe fox hunting as fun. I mean, I understand that's the way some people perceive it. I don't believe that to be the case, and I'm not naive enough to think that you do not have to kill animals at a certain time, but it's actually the manner of the killing that I personally find offensive. I simply think it's wrong for people...
Why is trapping and gassing and shooting?
Hold on, let me finish. Think it's wrong for people to chase a fox on horseback and then see that animal ripped limb from limb, because that's what happens within fox hunting. The other point I would make is, it's, you know, people say this has suddenly been sprung up as an electoral ploy. It was in our general election manifesto. I actually wrote to people in my constituency saying, vote Labour and you're actually going to get a ban on fox hunting.
But you haven't.
And I, amongst other, well, no, but we are going to get it, Mark. And I, amongst other Labour MPs, this isn't something the government has plucked out of the air. We have been lobbying like mad for the last 18 months to bring this bill forward, and I'm glad the government's done it.
A report came out on this last week that said that there are going to be like 5,000 job cuts.
I never want anybody to lose their job, but we actually used to have children going up chimneys and people cockfighting in this country.
But is it really that important that we're going to lose 5,000 jobs about it? Is it really that important?
If that's
foxes?
True.
Max is absolutely right, if that's true. And the Countryside Alliance have disgracefully inflated the number of jobs that they say are derived from fox hunting. They've actually given a figure of 16,000. I think when push comes to shove, and that's actually what the Burns Inquiry says, that at the end of the day, the job losses will be very, very minimal indeed. But someone said earlier about honesty in politics.
5,000 jobs is not minimal.
Well, no, hold on. It's about honesty in politics. I do not believe that a job is justified at any cost. And if the cost involves ripping an animal limb from limb for pleasure, I think it's wrong.
Right then. If you're really so concerned about animal cruelty, why have you picked this? If you actually think that animal cruelty is such an issue, you want to throw people out of work and pass laws banning it, what are you going to do about battery farms? What are you going to do actually about most slaughterhouses? If most of the people in this room knew the conditions under which the animals that they eat were killed, they'd be shocked and horrified. You're not truly concerned about cruelty to animals. You're concerned solely about an issue which you think will excite your more stupid supporters, who actually wrongly believe that fox hunting is an upper class activity pursued by people with silly accents and thick coats.
It isn't even true,
but it's another stupid rabble rousing class war issue which you've picked for cynical electoral ends, and which your leader, the alleged prime minister of this country, constantly claims has been prevented from being enacted by the House of Lords, which has never even discussed it. But he seems to think that it has.
Neil Hamilton.
Well, this is a completely bogus explanation, of course, because what is more pleasurable if you're a fisherman than putting a fly on the end of a hook which is going to end up in a fish's mouth? It's then going to be pulled out of the sea or out of a river. It's going to be asphyxiated on the bank or in the boat. That's what people do for fun. But you're not proposing to ban fishing. What about shooting? I don't hunt, shoot, or fish. But I've been on many shoots. Animals and birds are maimed and killed. Some of them can't always be found, so they die painful, lingering deaths wherever they fall. You're not planning to ban shooting because too many people enjoy these sports, and too many votes might be lost if you were to upset them. But we all know which way things are going, and if there were to be votes in proposing the banning or abolition of any of these sports, or as Peter Hitchens said a moment ago, broiler hens and so on and so forth, then no doubt you put that in your manifesto too. So there's no shred of principle behind all this. It's because you think this is a top sport and the majority of the country are against it.
Max Clifford.
No. I suppose you should ban football because look at the violence that leads to.
I
suppose my attitude is that I'd like to see the dog set on some of these hunting people and see how they respond when they're being chased through fields and things, and
that's pretty much what you do to people sometimes.
Well, I mean, I'd love to see that, Peter, you included. So let's hope that we can change the rules, you know, get the dogs to hunt the huntsmen. That would be great. I'd enjoy that. I'd enjoy watching that.
Never hunted in my life.
But do you not care about the 5,000 job losses?
Plenty of time. What?
Do you not care about the 5,000 job losses?
I don't believe that for 1 second. That's a load of propaganda put up by these people.
And you'll take all that back if 5,000 jobs are lost?
I'll take it all back if there's what?
if you'll take it all back.
I think this was in the Daily Conservative, or the Mail, as we call it, wasn't it?
There's a man over there reading it.
Yeah, exactly.
Mark, you're going to come in on this quickly before we move on.
I just can't get that worked up about it, to be perfectly honest. There are far too many important things in life to worry about than fox hunting. And from my judgment, I didn't vote to ban. Everyone told me it would cost me my by-election, and I won with 22,000 votes. You know, it's not a big issue. If people want to do that, that's fine. I guess that's the liberal in me. But I'm not a massive fan of government legislating, telling people what they can do with their own lives. I don't particularly like nude female darts or whatever it is that goes on television. But I'm not in the business of going around banning it. So from that perspective, don't care too much about it, but I'm not going to vote.
Yeah, but you have the choice. You can switch off. The foxes can't say go away.
Not a big issue.
I think Bill should tell us why he won't ban fishing and shooting.
Go on, Bill.
Let me come back to Peter's point, that the idea that this has been plucked out of the air. There are a whole raft of animal welfare pieces of legislation this government is putting through on fur farming, on the live transport of animals, on cosmetic testing and the rest of it. I think this government is rightly addressing the issue of animal welfare. And I also think, I genuinely believe, and I've always believed, that it's right to ban fox hunting. But I'm not alone in that view. If you look at every available piece of polling evidence, there is a massive majority in this country to ban fox hunting. Now, are they all wrong? No, I think they've rightly concluded that in a civilised society, it's simply unacceptable to kill and maim animals in that way. And interestingly, even in countryside areas, there is a significant majority in favour of a ban. I think it's something that whose time has come. I think it's right, and I think it's right that the government is doing it.
It does seem to me to be a reflection on our society that we can get ourselves into such a pother about this when 150,000 unborn babies are murdered in abortions every year, and nobody cares.
Okay, on that note, we'll move on to another question. Anyone else? Can you repeat the question, please?
Any chance of bringing back tarring and feathering for Tory party bosses? I don't think you seriously want an answer, do you?
We'll move on to another question. Jonathan Black.
Go back to your newspaper. It was better while you were reading it.
Jonathan. Mark Hudson.
What I find odd is, I'm a Watford, dare I admit it, season ticket holder.
You're the one.
I'm the one. which, despite that, does mean I do enjoy football. And one of the odd things is that if you have a German player, a French player playing for you, for your side, the crowd all chant out their name, they're happy to applaud that player, they're full on behind that player. There's not a hint of any nastiness, xenophobia towards that individual. The minute that our national team go abroad and play countries with those very players that they support week in, week out, they start making Nazi salutes and they start making xenophobia comments. And I just find that an absolute contradiction. I do not understand it. I suspect that what we have with so-called football hooligans is nothing to do with football, but the kind of thing that we had years back in Ibiza and stuff like that. Hot weather, youngsters together and drink lead to violence. And that's got very little to do with football and has got much more to do with human nature. And if we begin to understand the problem from that perspective, rather than saying that it's a race issue or it's a football issue, I think we begin to understand human nature more and we may find the solutions in that. I think, sadly, we try and put football issues tagged onto it and we try to put xenophobic issues tagged onto it when it has much more to do with drink, young people and hot weather.
No, I don't agree. I mean, as someone that goes to football a lot, I think it's happening at football grounds all over the country all the time. I can remember just a few years back when Crystal Palace were playing Wimbledon and Wimbledon had four black players and Crystal Palace had eight. I just happened to be sitting with the Crystal Palace supporters and they're shouting, "You load of black bastards," at the Wimbledon players, when most of their own team are black. You know, unfortunately, football is full of it. And as long as football clubs tolerate it because it brings in revenue, it will increase and increase. It's there, and it's there for everyone to see, but they turn a blind eye to it until it explodes at something like Brussels. It's been going on for years and years and years, and it's right the way through our game because so many of the people that go to football, and they're not fans of football, don't give a monkeys about the football. They're there because they're mindless morons and they want to cause trouble, and football is a place where they can do that.
Neil Hamilton.
Well, I don't play football or watch it either, so I'm not really qualified to comment on this, but in my limited experience of football hooligans, they're not as intellectual as Max, and nor are they so interested in politics. So I can't think that the explanation inferred by the question, implied by the question, is likely to be the answer. But I think Max is probably right, that there are mindless morons who, if they weren't watching or following football and causing trouble there, would be doing it somewhere else. So I don't think it has anything to do with the very serious arguments that we face on the future of Europe and the euro. I don't know what the average football hooligan's view of a single currency might be, but it seems to me much more to do with the collapse of authority in society in this country, and it goes back to the destruction of authority in the education system in the post-war period by the Labour Party for class-based reasons, and in the days when the Tory Party just bent the knee in a rather cowardly and timid way and accepted all this. Unfortunately, we continued the destruction of the education system, which produced such fine, upstanding figures as those that you see sitting on the platform this afternoon.
Thank you. Bill Rammel.
So, sorry, I've just got to pick up that issue because Peter tried to run with it as well, that, you know, this liberal establishment within education is causing all of our problems. The Labour Party's been in power for 19 out of the last 55 years. So, you know, let's get it into some historical context about who's responsible for the problems.
Well, I did say that.
I am a football fan and was horrified genuinely at what went on at the weekend. And I think, Neil, you're actually wrong. No, there's not well-developed political philosophy, but anyone who goes to a football ground in this country knows that for donkey's years, the National Front, the BNP, have been organising within football grounds because they see it as a place where their views can come forward. Anyone who watched the Panorama documentary after the Romania game on Tuesday of this week will have seen people in bars in Brussels chanting no surrender to the IRA. So it is clearly linked up with a sense of I believe, distorted nationalism. And I think we've got to face up to the fact that in this country we do have a job culture where racism, xenophobia and a complete disregard for your fellow citizen actually runs very strongly. And I think that is fuelled by the kind of rubbish we see week in, week out in our national newspapers, particularly the tabloids, that we're under threat from Europe, that Europe wants to control us. You know, the headlines about the Huns and the frogs. You cannot disassociate that diatribe of xenophobia that is coming forward to then some people in some circumstances, after a lot of drink and not with a great deal of education, actually then decide to take the law into their own hands and actually violently beat people up. And I think that's a real cause for concern to us, and we need to spend a long time thinking about it.
It's terribly sad, isn't it, that everyone's now saying that, you know, I won't be saying. Is that now that we've gone home, we can enjoy football. Everyone can relax and enjoy themselves. All the fans of all the different nations can now enjoy themselves. We've gone home. Isn't that sad?
Absolutely.
Peter Hitchens.
Two issues. One very quickly on football. There is some reason, I'm not quite sure what it is, that football seems to attract so much in the way of lowlife of all kinds. And one of the things which distresses me about football is the way in which otherwise sensible, intelligent and educated people suck up to it and say, oh, I go to such and such, I belong to such and such, I always attend such and such. How the Prime Minister pitifully pretends that he's a football fan and has himself filmed watching football games.
Oh, John Major at Chelsea.
The very same, yes. Yeah. Utterly pathetic, grovelling to what they believe to be popular culture when in fact it is a focus for violence, unpleasantness and drunkenness. Yes, these things are the result of the collapse of authority, the collapse of education, the collapse of the family, all the things which the liberal 60s generation, who may not have been in government but have been in power in many, many other places, notably the education system and the BBC for much of this time, and who just celebrated themselves in a wonderful series called My Generation by Joan Bakewell, which I hope you all watched. But that is one issue. The other issue, and I very much object to the questioner trying to suggest that there is any link whatsoever between opposition to the European Union and the hatred of the stupid, boneheaded hatred of foreigners and foreign things which has taken place in Brussels and which often takes place at football grounds. This absurd and frankly defamatory use of the word xenophobia to describe an honest concern for the democracy and independence of this country. Among many people, most of the people who I know who are classified as Eurosceptics know a great deal more about the continent of Europe than you do, sir. For instance, I've lived there, which I doubt whether you have. And I don't know how many European languages you speak. But to be described as xenophobic under such circumstances is actually insulting. So perhaps you'd like to justify.
Let him reply to that. Let him reply to that.
In French, please.
I'm not anti-European. I'm against the European Union, which doesn't encompass Europe at all. No, it's not. Give me an instant. Give me just one instant. Well, just give me one then.
Some front page saying hop off you.
Well, let him finish, please.
Yes, the Daily Mirror is in favour of us abandoning our independence and scrapping the past.
He's given you examples. You asked for examples.
It's an example. He's linking your responsible political Euroscepticism with stupid with and he's just instanced the Daily Mirror, which is a paper in favour of this country throwing away the pound and abandoning its independence in the European Union. As an instance of this, the two simply aren't linked.
I thought what he was saying was that tabloid press stir up hatred against Europeans. I totally agree with that. Anybody that reads The Sun, I mean, I know not many people read your paper, Peter, but anybody that reads The Sun or even The Mail or even The Mirror would have seen a load of racist propaganda over the years, because I see it all the time. So I'm sure that that helps.
By Euroskeptics.
I'm sure that helps to create the kind of problems that we've just seen demonstrated in Brussels. And it's in the national press all the time.
Do you want to very quickly reply to that before we end? Thank you for that. Okay, well, on that note, we'll end there. Unfortunately, some of the speakers have to leave. However, in the autumn, we have other events as well, including David Schindler, Mohammed Al-Fayed, and the Duchess of York, which you can look forward to. Very quickly, I would just like to thank all the Question Time Society members, not all at one go. Question Time Society members for their work throughout the year, and the stewards for their work today, and everyone in the audience for coming along. And finally, if you can join me in thanking the panel for coming along today. Thank you.